good.
I'm going to tell you something, Flacca, and I want you to listen tight.
Telling stories to regular folks is not a trivial thing.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
Even if it's hard to explain, even if you know they don't really want to hear it, not really, I urge you to give it a try.
You have my undivided attention.
Take a chance, find the words, find the metaphor, share the beauty, tell them a story.
Today on Pioneer Radio, we bring you stories of the pursuit of happiness. A lot of the time, when people ask about happiness, they ask about what it is. And what they're really asking about is what happiness is made of. Is happiness made of material goods? Is it made of a good collection of friends? A secure job? In today's episode, we want to ask a slightly different question. It's only slightly different because we'll get to see what happiness is made of eventually, but we'll come to see that by asking a different question. And here it is. When we say that we're pursuing happiness, is the happiness that we're talking about subjective or objective? In other words, does every person decide for him or herself what happiness is? That would be the subjective kind, because it depends on the experience of different subjects. Or is there a kind of happiness that all of those personal preferences hold in common? That's the objective happiness, one that encompasses all of the different kinds of happiness under an umbrella definition. Let me give you some examples.
For a New Yorker, happiness is finding the group of people who you identify with. Like, it's a city of 8 million people, and, you know, you go in knowing no one. Most times, you know no one. And once you find, you know, your niche, it's just the most rewarding thing in the world because so many of us are, like, feel like misfits from other cities. And it's like the Island of the Lost Toys, you know, like, you go in, and you're like, there are thousands of other weirdos just like me. And so, you know, after so many years of not identifying with anyone, finding your, you know, group of weirdos, that's when you're happiest, I think.
Don't worry, be happy. Here in Ontario, I think it would be contested highly, but as a Manitoban, I think for Métis people, there's sort of an accepted community and it's well established and it's thriving, and happiness is just, it can be very political, maybe asserting the rights of hunting and land rights, land claims and things like that. That's a big focus of the organized Métis political segment of the population in Manitoba. But when it comes to just local communities, when you think of happiness, it's just community gatherings and feasts together, and it's about music and family and just having a good time. And that's kind of any Métis community that you might be welcomed into, they'll feast you, they'll have music, and there could be storytelling and stuff like that, but it's mostly just about family and tradition.
When you're worried, your face will frown, and that will bring everybody down. So don't worry, be happy, don't worry, be happy now.
Each one of these responses sounds different at first. For one, happiness involves retaining a sense of culture and community despite outside pressures. For another, happiness involves striking out on one's own in search of a new community. But if we step back and take them together, we start to notice some similarities. Happiness is people to have fun with. Happiness is having a good community. So we're left with the question, which is the real happiness? The first one that we feel subjectively, that is, according to our own personal experience? Or the one that binds all of those little pleasures together according to a universal standard of happiness, with a capital H? This is the driving question behind today's show. As is often the case on Pioneer Radio, there is no really clear answer to this question. But the pursuit is what matters, right?
It will soon pass, whatever it is. Don't worry, be happy.
First, for an argument in favor of subjective happiness, we're going to look at some art. In Toronto, there's a musician named Charles Spirin who collects happinesses. Charles released an album on the label Arts and Crafts called The Happiness Project. Basically, Charles recorded his neighbors talking about happiness and then took those recordings and played instruments along with the cadence of his neighbors' voices. Mrs. Morris is a tenor saxophone. Charles's daughter, Ondine, is a violin. Maybe this is hard to imagine, so here's a recording released by Arts and Crafts of Charles Spirin talking about the inspiration and method behind the Happiness Project. You can watch the video that accompanies this recording at www.happiness-project.ca.
One, okay. Send me home, send me home, send me home, send me home.
Well, I've always wanted to do music based on the melody of people talking. I used to sit and listen to my mother and my father talk. My dad has this great deep bass voice. It's a very gentle voice, but it's a very deep voice. And I talk and he'd be... And my mom has a very sharp voice, which is... kind of like Charlie Brown. And I wouldn't really listen to what they were saying. There would be this constant back and forth of the low voice and the high voice. And I would sort of carry that listening technique and walk around onto the streets and, you know, walking through a park or something that would be a tree full of starlings and they'd all be chattering away like mad. And it has kind of the same effect as walking past a cafe full of people talking. And there's this sense of listening to the sounds of the world with a different perspective. Repeatedly imagine what the world is like if you can't see. And so that may be some of the initial impetus behind the Happiness Project. But ultimately, when I started doing it, it was an experiment, and I just kind of wanted to see where it would go.
So I have 16 electrodes inserted in my cochlea. And then I learned that sound is electricity. And all the different sounds move differently inside of me. So when it goes off, all of a sudden everything in my body is still. Yeah. And I now understand the term dead silence.
I chose to do the project based on my neighbor's speech. They're only connected to me because of geography, and for that sense, they're basically a random group of people. But there's different song qualities to their voices, and so I thought I'd take these people I don't know so well and ask them about life. I think from taking a certain random selection of people, it did inspire me to think that most people in the world actually are quite intelligent and quite kind and quite wise. You can take a bunch of random people and just put them in a situation where they're kind of comfortable, get them to talk about a nice subject like happiness, and then their wisdom shines a little bit more.
Happiness is love. Happiness is love. Love make you keep happy. You can't just love yourself and you don't love other people. You got to love people. And the love is right there. It makes you feel happy to know that you're my neighbor. And I love you. And you could be able to come over today to invite me over. What do you think that is? I'm feeling happy.
Same.
Yes.
It's a simple recipe.
Yes. I'm feeling happy. Yeah. To know that, you know, somebody cares. And that's a big love.
I actually played this to all my neighbors, and they all love what Mrs. Morris has to say.
Happiness is love.
Love makes you keep happy. And I think that's pretty universal. The simplicity of being able to go out and talk to your neighbors. I don't think she's not talking about, you know, romantic love. She's talking about simple love. And the love is right there.
The Happiness Project is really worth a listen. Charles Spearin shows us how sound permeates our lives, all of the time, everywhere. But for our purposes today, we need to look at what the Happiness Project says about, well, happiness. Mrs. Morris says that happiness is love, and who would want to contradict her? Who would want to say, "No, Mrs. Morris, I'm sorry, happiness is not love, happiness is love only for you"? Probably no one would want to say that. One thing about places like Canada, where people are free to think and say pretty much whatever they want, is that those places take subjectivity very seriously. That Mrs. Morris is free to say that happiness is love is not only important because she tells us something about happiness, but it's important because she said it. Happiness is love in her experience, and we value that experience because it is hers.
It's easy. Ah, you only need.
What about when two different subjective ideas about what happiness is come into conflict? What if, like Mrs. Morris, you've got someone who believes that happiness is love? And what if you've got someone who believes the opposite extreme? Maybe that there is no happiness at all? Who is right? And how would we know? Well, we would need some sort of test that could equally apply to both opinions. We would need some kind of objective standard.
You can do what you want. The opportunity's on. And if you find a new way, you can do it today. You can make it all true. And you can make it undo. You see. Ah, it's easy. Ah, you only need to know.
Luckily, there's a philosophy professor at the University of Waterloo that's working on the pursuit of objective happiness.
I'm Brian Arend. I'm a professor of philosophy and director of international studies at the University of Waterloo.
Brian's not writing just any book on happiness. He's writing a book on how to be happy in spite of illness.
This project on happiness, is it going to be a book or is it just a
yes.
project?
Yes, it is very much going to be a book with the title Seizure the Day. Happiness in spite of illness. So I wanted to have a kind of distinctive contribution, but the main motivator for the project is personal, because I'm epileptic, hence the seizure reference, and kind of out of the blue, when I was 30, I had a history of perfect health, and I started having grand mal seizures in front of my classes, even. The poor kids, you know, thought I was croaking, right? And And I went through years of testing, and I had misdiagnoses and just real Canadian healthcare system strikes again kind of stuff. And it destroyed my marriage and just created all kinds of real problems in my life. So it created a lot of misery for me, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when I was young, you know, I never really thought about happiness, right? Because you're just too busy doing stuff, right? You know, I never really thought about happiness. I was just too busy doing stuff, getting credentials, doing what I wanted to do. But with this kind of big health and kind of life challenge, you know, it really created a lot of misery in me. And I knew I wanted to change that and to get happier. Hence, my interest in happiness, right? Because my other professional interests are very different. Mm-hmm. They're in post-war reconstruction and human rights. Just, I guess, given current affairs, there's, like, endless appetite for the war stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, I could just keep... Like, I get invitations all the time. I could just keep churning out the war stuff. But I don't know if you've heard the phrase war whore. So,
not yet.
So let me introduce you to the glories of that phrase. So I didn't want to end up as a war whore, but it was really just a personal drive that, you know, I suffered from a lot of unhappiness, you know, through no fault of my own. And just with the misdiagnosis and things like that, you know, I had to deal with it for years, right? So I really, you know, got confronted with struggle and misery, and so how to kind of claw my way out of there.
Clawing his way out of misery was not easy. Here's Brian talking about his first seizure, in public, in class, and the trauma that grand mal seizures induce.
It was in a moral issues class, so this is back in 01, a few weeks after 9/11, in fact. I don't remotely remember what I was lecturing about. But anyway, apparently I just kind of stopped and I looked off to the side and I just stopped talking. And then I kind of crashed back. Everyone thought I was having a heart attack because apparently I like really kind of closed in on my chest. And I just smashed back into the blackboard and then, you know, like I was just like a billiard ball. But I was fine. Like, I didn't... Like, you hear some of these horror stories of, like, people, like, yeah, cracking their heads open and stuff. So, I mean, I did have a bunch of, like, contusions and lacerations and stuff, but nothing was broken or anything like that. And I woke up, like, maybe even the next day. Like, I woke, you know, a long, long time recovering and, you know, the first seizure I'd ever had. So, obviously, my students... took over and called someone and the ambulance came and got me, and I've had a lot of seizures in public now, and every time someone has helped me. Mm-hmm. So I mean, that's, you know, that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah,
you know, I've never had anyone take advantage of me, and I've had dozens of seizures in public, and you know, I've woken up many a time staring at the ceiling of an ambulance, and every time someone has helped me.
Do you know who it is normally?
You know, I would say only about half the time. And half the time, no. What's that line? I've always relied on the kindness of strangers. Mm-hmm. Is that Streetcar? Streetcar Named Desire?
Yeah.
So I have experienced that myself, yeah. Huh. So.
Before we get into the nitty-gritty of Brian's project, let's see where he anticipates it will fit among other projects on happiness.
And of course, this... ton of stuff on happiness out there, and self-help and mm-hmm. positive psychology and religious stuff and philosophical stuff as well. There is stuff, but nowhere near the same amount or quality of stuff giving advice to people who live with chronic conditions mm-hmm. and how they can be happy. There's a few books. There's one called The Gift of Pain. You know, it's profound and moving, but for me, like, I'm not in constant pain or anything like that, right? But I do have a chronic condition. So I think that there's a lot of people out there that are sort of like me. Chronic condition hampers the pursuit of happiness. What's possible for people like that in terms of the pursuit of happiness? Mm-hmm. And so this kind of, the books can be a blend of kind of my experience, that kind of driving motivation, and then just all of the kind of philosophical and psychological research that I've done. Yeah.
The title, The Gift of Pain, just to return to that book, sounds like finding happiness in the illness.
Yeah.
And then your project sounds more like finding happiness in spite of illness. Is that an accurate
reference? Yeah, generally, that's true. That's true. Although I think over the years and with enough kind of thought and detachment, you can realize that, you know, painful things and illness can give you gifts that you otherwise wouldn't have had, because it forces you to deal with reality in a different kind of way. But in the main, you're right. It's kind of happiness in spite of it, kind of a defiant kind of attitude. At the same time, you know, I think it's too much to be grateful to your illness, but you can learn things about it and grow in your humanity and your open-mindedness. And
keep in mind that we're not just talking about one person anymore. Brian does not plan to write a completely subjective manifesto about his experience with grand mal seizures. He's writing a guidebook that anyone in a similar situation could follow in their pursuit of happiness. Because this project isn't just one that works only for Brian, it's more than just a subjective take on happiness and illness. It also contains elements that Brian thinks can provide a loose strategy that will lead to happiness for almost all of us.
The real debate comes down to, is happiness purely subjective, or is there something objective involved, right? So the common view is it is purely subjective, right? You know, whatever gives you pleasure, who am I to tell you what makes you happy or not? But the problem with that would seem to be, let's say, the example of a drug addict or something like that, right? Now, they can make themselves very happy, right, very quickly. But it seems wrong to say that they're a happy person, right? I mean, they experience pleasure, sure, when they're getting their high on, right? But are they a happy person? And I think most people's instincts is to say no, that there's something wrong, there's something artificial, or at least incomplete. So if it's incomplete, what's the further thing that needs to be added, though, right? What kind of objective thing needs to be added? I think it must have something to do with kind of functioning, some kind of well-functioning, or at least the avoidance of ill function to the extent that you can. So kind of putting those two things together, just as a working kind of definition, the gaining of pleasure from activities that are sustainable and non-destructive over the long term, something like that. And what's surprising is actually there's this shocking commonality about the sorts of things that reliably produce happiness in the majority of the population.
Like what?
Right? So having goals in life, vital, big or small, which makes a lot of sense, right? Like directionless people, you know, easy to, you know, get depressed, wonder about your self-worth. Okay, so a goal, robust social life, avoidance of sickness, avoidance of addictive substances, a healthy sex life, other sensual pleasures like food, getting lots of sleep, not harming others, the avoidance of extreme behavior in general, right? So moderation in all things,
yeah.
As they say, right? Some kind of, I guess this ties in with the goal, either a spiritual life or at least some kind of worldview that provides direction and coherence. Now, this is disputed in the literature, right? Because a lot of people, you know, I mean, and you know academics, right? So, you know, a lot of them are non-believers, right? So a lot of people think the happiness boost from spirituality comes from the social aspect, right? It's that you go to church. It's that you can draw upon those people. It's additional friends. It's got nothing to do with belief in God and it being a settling kind of thing. That's disputed, though. Now, there's a lot of general associations between control over circumstance and happiness.
Oh,
so, thing with children, career, emphatically. The more control you have, it's way more associated than money, right? Money is not robustly associated with happiness. Lack of money is robustly associated with misery,
right?
So, poverty and unemployment, guaranteed misery. But once you hit a certain kind of threshold of money and you're comfortable, winning the lottery beyond there, it doesn't have robust, sustained improvements in your happiness.
Do you know what that figure is?
Yeah, well,
the threshold they
say in North America it's 75,000 a year. So that's very specific. No, but in a way that's ridiculous, though, right? Because 75 grand in New York, what does this buy you versus 75 grand in Saskatchewan, right? I mean, it's control over work, it's autonomy in the workplace is way more important to your career satisfaction than the actual amount of money, right? So control, taking care of yourself physically, social connections, gratitude, cultivating a kind of an attitude of gratitude is one of the most reliable things. In fact, if I can share with whoever's going to listen to this, one of the most effective happiness-boosting strategies, it's second only to pharmaceutical intervention with, like, the most depressed people, is this. Every night before you go to bed, make a list of three things that increase your happiness that day. And it can be anything. It's whatever. I like the way that the donut tasted. You know, it can be huge. It can be trivial. If you do that on a regular basis, you have the same improvement in happiness as if you've been prescribed medication. It just transforms your mindset, right? Of instead of all the things that make you anxious and you're resentful about, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. It just transforms your mindset into, yeah, that was great. You know, these are the things that I have to be grateful for.
Mm-hmm. So you listed control over your situation, illness, a social network, and gratitude.
Yeah.
And it seems like when you introduce something like illness into you no longer have control.
Good, great.
Your social network might exist, but it's with other people who are ill, you're isolated because of your illness.
It makes you interior.
Yeah. You have to be the kind of person that's thankful for their situation when that might seem impossible.
That's right.
So how does it work? How are you happy in spite of your illness if it cuts you off?
I mean, I think there's, realistically, there's a transition period where you have to confront those things, and it's about kind of toughing it out to see how gratitude can be possible for you given that kind of condition. Mm-hmm. Obviously, getting the best medical help, empowering yourself with knowledge, resisting the temptation to become interior that sickness brings upon you, even if that means, so you socialize with new people who understand your illness, right? Some people move away, move away from sick people, that's life. So I think there's a kind of toughening and a transition phase where you have to ask yourself, now that I'm sick, how can those things work for me? So how can I still be as fit as possible for me? Mm-hmm. How can I still eat as well as possible, sleep as well as possible for me? How can I socialize as much as I can? How can I be grateful for this? So it's a challenge, right? But in a way, I guess that's the whole point of this kind of book is how can sick people meet those challenges to the best extent that they can? Mm-hmm. And the thing that really comes across, though, is it's really possible to do way more than what you expect. Like, you know, it's very easy when you get hit with a chronic diagnosis to let it level you. And but most people I know who've kind of really set out to increase their happiness have been able to do way more than what they ever initially thought possible. Mm-hmm.
You've been listening to Pioneer Radio on CFRU 93.3. That's our show. Thanks for listening.
Les étoiles chaque nuit sont épatées, sont amoureuses encore une fois. Autrement, elles seraient fatiguées avec le ciel et tout cela. Elles diraient pourquoi prier. Love you.